This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
This is Reset. I'm Esther Yoon-ji Kang in for Sasha Ann Simons. Bugs that play plants like musical instruments, platypus bills that sense electric fields, butterflies that taste with their feet, squirrels that can't feel the cold of winter. In his newest book, An Immense World, science writer Ed Yong takes us inside the sensory world of animals and reveals endless diversity in how they perceive their surroundings, in many cases experiencing things completely invisible to us. More than a fascinating exploration of animal senses, it's also a call to action. We talk to Yong about how sources of pollution humans may not even notice, like light and noise, are making it harder and harder for animals to keep on sensing and surviving. To start, what was it like switching from reporting on the pandemic to animals?
It honestly felt a bit like coming home, and it was just a salve for my weary soul. It's difficult to continue writing about the ongoing tragedy that is the COVID pandemic, and this felt like not just a shift in terms of topic, but a shift in terms of tone. The thing I'm writing about, the ways other animals experience the world, the extraordinary senses that they have, is I think a topic of joy and wonder. It's a field that expands our understanding of the world around us and makes us see things that were familiar in new and unfamiliar ways. It has that sort of galaxy brain, you know, rushing out to tell your friends some cool facts feeling that has characterized a lot of my work before the pandemic, and you know, and was a joy to delve back into.
You write a lot about the multiple overlapping crises we're facing, a pandemic, climate change, social and economic inequality. You've talked about all those things here on Reset in the past. So why is this book about animals important right now in this moment?
I think at its core, An Immense World is a book about radical acts of empathy. It's about trying to take the perspective of creatures that are incredibly different to us in the way they see and hear and feel and smell. In many ways, I think a total failure of empathy underlies many of the big problems we face today, including many of the problems that have been exposed by the pandemic, the inequalities we face, our inability to understand the experiences of people who've suffered more than we might have. So I think there's this common thread of trying to cast your mind into the lives of others who are very different than you, whether it's, you know, animals that sense the world in a different way, or whether it's people who have less fortunate experiences. That's something that I'm not suggesting that thinking about how dogs smell or how bats echolocate is going to fix our big social problems. But I think like empathy is a muscle that we can build and flex.
You write in the book that senses, quote, transform the coursing chaos of the world into experiences, and that they allow biology to tame physics. What do you mean by that?
So the book's organized in chapters that each deal with a kind of stimulus. So whether it's light or sound or pressure or heat, and how animals sense them. The one thing that unites all of these things is they're all kind of abstract quantities, and there's really no you know, it's not a given that we should be able to detect them at all. And it's kind of wondrous that we do. Like, sound is just pressure waves coursing through the air. Light is just electromagnetic radiation. Smell is just small molecules drifting through the air. The fact that we have the hardware that can detect all of these qualities in the world around us, and then, you know, and then the ability to actually turn them into the majesty of a sunset or the smell of baking bread or all the other, you know, great subjective experiences that we have, that's kind of extraordinary in its own right. So, you know, the fact that we can sense the world at all is just baseline extremely cool. And the fact that what we sense, even though it feels all encompassing to us, it feels like all there is to know, the fact that it is actually only a thin sliver of all there is to know, and that other animals perceive different parts of the fullness of reality, is, I think, even more extraordinary still.
Yeah, I mean, the intro grabbed me right away. You start the book by asking us to imagine being in a gym with wild animals, and that there are all these things that they can and cannot perceive about one another. Can you walk us through that awesome example?
Right. So it talks about imagining a large room, probably a school gym, in which there's like an elephant, a robin, a bumblebee, a spider, a bat, a rattlesnake, a dog, a mouse. So a lot of these animals are in the same space, and a human. And their experiences of that space that they physically share are going to be radically different. The snake, for example, will detect the body heat of the mouse running through the room. The mouse can hear ultrasonic high-pitched frequencies that the bat can hear, but the elephant can't. The elephant can hear low-pitched infrasound that all the other creatures can't sense. The robin can detect the magnetic field of the earth and use that field to guide its migration. So that intro, that hypothetical example, is sort of doing double duty. First, it's saying all of these animals can be in the same space and have an utterly different experience. And it's my sort of vivid way of trying to get people to understand that. But it also is an act of imagination. And that is probably the most important thing that I'm going to ask readers to repeatedly do in the book. Like, I can tell you the science behind, say, a rattlesnake's infrared sense or a bat's echolocation, but to actually understand what it perceives, to think about its subjective experience, is a little unknowable and requires these imaginative leaps. And again, you know, like much like empathy, that's a muscle that we can build and that I'm going to ask readers to build over the course of the book.
That's interesting. You talk a lot in the book about Umwelt. What is an Umwelt?
So an Umwelt is a sensory bubble. It is the thin sliver of all the information out there in the world that we can perceive. You know, it's the unique combination of sights and smells and textures and sounds that we can perceive, but that another animal might not be able to. So, for example, the magnetic field that the robin can sense is part of its Umwelt, but not part of mine. The color red is part of my Umwelt, but not part of a bumblebee's, for example. And so this concept like anchors the entire book. And I love it because it's quite humbling. And for all of our like grandstanding as this, you know, incredible species, we humans are only still grasping a tiny fraction of the fullness of reality.
Yeah, so is the takeaway that we are just trapped by our own limited senses, or is there a more positive way to look at it?
Yeah, so in some ways, yes, we are trapped. The Umwelt concept can feel constrictive, like limiting in that way. But I actually think it's expansive because we do have this ability as a species to think about the Umwelts of other creatures. And I don't think that's an ability that's very common. You know, I don't think a rattlesnake is sitting there thinking, what does a robin sense? Or even is aware that the robin senses different things. We do. The zoologist Jacob van Uxkull, who pioneered the Umwelt concept, built it as a sort of travelogue, you know, that you could go on journeys through the sensory worlds of other animals just by thinking about them and understanding them. And I think there's something quite magical and very profoundly human about doing that, you know, to do this, to go on these journeys, expands our own minds, lets us see like boring things in the world in new and wondrous ways. It feels like a gift to me and one that we really ought to cherish.
So as a human with the senses that you have, how did you approach writing your way into all these other animals' sensory worlds without portraying them? I know you crawled and did like a smell test like a dog, but how did you, how'd you do that without portraying them through the bias of your own senses?
So I did a lot of travel for this book. I went to three different continents. I met a lot of scientists who work with a lot of interesting animals. You know, went traipsing around California looking for rattlesnakes, and I got punched by a mantis shrimp in Australia. So it is hard, right? It's very hard to just sit there and watch an animal and actually think like what is its Umwelt. But fortunately, a lot of people over decades and centuries have actually tried to address this question. They've done interesting studies and experiments. And those people have also thought a lot about what other animals might experience. So part of the technique of the book was trying to tell the stories of the researchers who work in the space. You know, I'm trying to get people who study electric fish to speculate about what it might be like to sense through the world through the electric fields that you yourself might generate. And I found that the people who do work in this area really have thought hard about the sort of philosophical implications of their science. And I think that's part of the richness of this topic and that I hope to bring out in the book.
So the chapters of this book walk us through animal senses one by one, like smells, tastes, color, heat, sound, and electric fields, to name just a few. But you also explain how senses can overlap, like how ant neurons can sense smell and touch at the same time, or how people can experience synesthesia. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I think we're used to thinking of the senses as separate buckets, right? Like with humans, we have the classic Aristotelian five senses, but they aren't actually that discrete, and especially not in other animals. So, you know, an ant might both taste and touch with its antennae. It might be able to feel a flavor or be able to taste a shape. And, you know, that extends to a lot of other animals too. You know, I talk about in that chapter about the bill of the duck-billed platypus has mechanosensors that detect touch and pressure, and also electric sensors that detect electric fields. And there are some people who think that maybe all of these things fuse into a single sense of electro-touch. Humans have something a little bit similar to that. We have a lot of people have synesthesia, where the senses blur into each other. Mm. So people might associate like a number or a sort of abstract concept with a smell or a color. But I think those kinds of perceptual blurring are actually quite commonplace for a lot of other animals.
So what animal sensory mysteries are still unsolved?
I think there are lots. So I've got a whole chapter in the book about vibration sensors, so being able to detect the waves that move along the solid surfaces that we touch and on which we stand. A lot of animals do this, but it's a little neglected. You know, I talk in the book about how elephants might be able to use this kind of seismic sense to communicate over long distances, how insects called leafhoppers are sending vibrational songs through the plants around us all the time without us being aware of it. And then there are senses where there are still huge mysteries. With vision, a sense that most of us are familiar with, I know what's responsible for vision. I have two eyes. I know the cells in those eyes that detect light. But I don't know what the sense organs or what the receptors are for magnetoreception, the ability that birds and turtles and other animals use to detect Earth's magnetic field. Mm. That's a very counterintuitive sense. People have tried to puzzle over what's the organ that senses magnetic fields for a long time. And there's been multiple dead ends, multiple false leads. The sense of the world of animal senses has been studied for decades, centuries, maybe even millennia. But there is still so much to discover. And one of the scientists I talked to published a paper just a few years ago that was titled, we really don't know anything, do we?
Yeah, that part made me laugh out loud. Ed, this book is a joy to read. But of course, when it comes to the natural world, we can't ignore the devastating effects we've had on ecosystems and wildlife. Your last chapter touches on some of that, like how we've boosted noise levels in our oceans to levels OSHA wouldn't approve of, to the detriment of marine life. How do the problems of light and noise pollution, for example, compare to other types of pollution we've maybe heard more about?
Yeah, I think they are substantial and important. We have flooded the world with sensory pollution, that stimuli like light, noise, and other things that drown out the cues that animals need, the alarm calls and mating sounds that they rely upon. Those stimuli that we put into the world distract animals from things they need to pay attention to, might push them out of areas that would otherwise be ideal for them because it's too bright or too noisy. Through light and noise pollution, we waylay migrating birds from their paths, often with fatal results. You know, we have collapsed the amount of space over which whales and other oceanic animals can hear because we filled that space with the din of noisy ships. You know, these problems are significant, and I think we ignore them in a sort of paradoxical way. Light and sound should be things that are very obvious to us, but we neglect their impact because we don't think of them as pollutants. You know, light, for example, is something we want more of, but if we flood it into the world at times where it doesn't belong, we cause problems for the animals around us in ways that are, you know, I think just as dramatic as, say, plastic pollution or, you know, chemicals billowing out of a smokestack, but are less obvious to us because we just don't think of them as negative things.
So really quickly, just what can we do?
A lot of the things we can do are actually pretty simple. So we can put up sound-absorbing structures around roads. We can force ships to move at slower speeds, which is also an economic boon. We can turn off lights at night in public buildings, in our own homes. We can do small individual actions, but also big policy changes to reduce light and noise. And I think we should do that. Like, unlike things like, say, pesticides or plastics, you know, radioactive wastes, unlike these things which are going to last in the environment for a long time, even if we stop all production tomorrow, light and noise, if we just turn them off, they disappear and immediately. This is a rare example of an ecological gimme, like a problem that is huge in scope, but that can be quickly addressed if we have the political will to do so and if we recognize that this genuinely is a problem.
That's award-winning science reporter Ed Yong. Ed, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. That was a delight.
That episode of the Reset podcast was produced by Christian Elliott and Ethan Schwab. It was edited by Stephanie Kim. I'm Esther Yunji Kang in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again soon.